So here is my problem, Avalone. So Marty goes back to 1885 to save Doc, right? Doc is ultimately not killed in 1885. And so his tombstone would no longer be present in 1955. So if there was no tombstone in 1955, then Marty would not know that he has to go back to 1885 to save Doc. But if Marty does not go back to 1885, then Doc is going to die, right?
What if Doc planted the tombstone even though he didn't die? To solve this paradox, Doc could have, I mean, it's just a piece of stone. He could have put it up in a cemetery with those years on it just to make. And also that's before Marty sees that before the timeline is changed again and the change ripples through history. So it's the same thing. It's like the branch with the branch where what's his name has the sports book, where Trump has the sports book, vanishes completely from history. I can't remember his name. The guy who's
Biff.
Trump. Yeah, Biff. So I think the branch gets erased.
There you go.
I think that's the answer. It's like
Mind
Edith Keeler.
blow. Season five of the Telly Award-winning podcast, coming at you like Marty McFly, aka Clint Eastwood in 1885, facing off with Buford Mad Dog Tannen, doing our killing before noon and looking like dude it up egg-sucking gutter trash. I am Ryland Grant, taking a breath now, screenwriter, egg-sucking gutter trash, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant Banjax and available on Kickstarter right now, The Jump. Go on over and check it out. The other voice in the dark, if you are just listening. But the man in the box to the left on our brand new YouTube channel is.
David Avalone, writer, coffee achiever, and this is not a holdup, it is a science experiment.
I love every second of it. If you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many, many more, our entire catalog can be celebrated via Apple Pods and other purveyors of worthwhile ear crack. And it is all slowly but surely making its way onto this new YouTube channel. We're doing pretty well. We are building steadily. The watch hours are like out of this world, I guess, for a fledgling channel. So we got that going for us. But you can help if you are watching right now. Smash the subscribe button, smash the like button, tell a friend, do all that good stuff. Help us out. We have a great show today. I'm very excited about this guest. I've been talking about having this guest on for like 2 or 3 years right now. We finally got him, so that's awesome. But let's get a little promo out of the way. You got something to pimp before we get into it, Avalone?
When I had to pimp, let's see, Savage Tales is in stores now. Drawing Blood 7 is in stores now. 8's coming any minute now. And I'm gonna be at WonderCon at the end of this month in Anaheim doing some panels.
Yeah,
That's
I'll be
about
at
it.
one.
What do you
I'll be
got
at
going
Wonder.
on?
I'll be at WonderCon too. You know, lots of good stuff going on there with friends and family and all that stuff. Like I said, The Jump is available on Kickstarter. The entire Ryland Grant Half Evil Comics library is available on Kickstarter right now. The Jump 4. We take on the election in glorious fashion. You're not going to want to miss that one. So go check that out. I announced formally on social media today that Half Evil Comics, we have partnered with the Ben Free Project, which is kind of a carceral activist group, to go into the California State Prison at Lancaster and teach comic creation to some folks who are who are working on themselves there. So that's exciting. That starts formally in 2 weeks. So yeah, I'm excited to writing saved me. Making comic books saved me. I have, you know, I therapy has been okay. It's never really worked for me. What has worked for me is getting my demons on a page and beating the tar out of them. So I'm driving up to Lancaster to help some guys do just that. So should be cool. So big announcement. Feel pretty good about it, and I will I'll update y'all on it as we go on. But we're talking too much. Let's get Felipe in.
I like to see you finally paying your debt to society, Ryan. This is that's what's important here. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Felipe Caño.
Hey everyone. Let me see if I can do justice to your awesome intros. I'm Felipe Caño. I'm co-creator of the Fuming Curse, barbecue master, like any good Brazilian, you know, behind the grill.
Sure.
And Corinthians football fan, and that's the real football, not American football. Ooh. Even though I enjoy that too, but it's the actual, I'm not calling it soccer. It's not soccer.
How is your jiu-jitsu game? Because, you know, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to encounter a Brazilian and not hear about some jiu-jitsu. Are you into it or no?
No, not at all. I'm a peace lover.
There you go.
I can't fight for, you know, I can fight.
Me neither.
I can make my characters fight. They're awesome, you know.
Yeah, there you go.
But I'd rather, like, if you pick a fight with me, I'd rather feed you some nice barbecue and have a drink, and we'll work it out.
I like it.
Sounds like a very, very solid plan. So you currently, right now, have on Kickstarter The Few and the Cursed number 11?
I do, actually. So The Few and Cursed, which is a weird Western. And yes, we have issue number 11 on Kickstarter right now. We've been doing this for a while now, both Fabiano Neves and myself. He's the artist, I'm the writer, and we've been around for 10 years now with this
amazing and always on Kickstarter.
Always on Kickstarter. We've done comics, original graphic novels, board games, RPGs. We had a music project, you know, score. I shot a couple of shorts, so we've been all over the place with it.
Yeah, and I've been watching it the whole time, and as I sort of teased in the beginning, I've been, you know, trying to have Felipe on for a little while now. I've been in since the beginning. It's a great book, and it was one of the first really great prolific Kickstarter books. I've watched him, you know, build this business on the platform, and sort of lay down a process that many have kind of copied, you know, to maybe not to the success that he has, but
Rylan froze up for a second.
There you go. I was just saying it's been amazing to watch him kind of build this business on Kickstarter, and so it's great to have him here to talk about it and you know to clue us in on how the hell he did it. Yeah.
So I want to ask, you know, our origin story stuff, like, were you doing comics before Kickstarter?
Origin story. So I went to film school. I learned how to write scripts at Chapman. So, you know, in Anaheim, where you guys are going to be very, very soon. Mm-hmm. And I remember writing a script and showing it to both in class and to my bosses at the two intern places that I was interning at. And I heard from both of them, without them talking to each other, that this is a great script. It will never get made. Because you're a 20 something Brazilian, you know, trying to do $100 million film. So not going to happen. And that stung a little bit because I kind of learned firsthand that in Hollywood, doesn't matter whether you have a good story, you know, it's a lot of moving parts that having a good script in your hands, just one of them. So, and while interning, I saw a lot, I did a lot of reading of scripts. Like I did the, I cover them. And I remember, like, some of my favorite scripts never saw the light of the day. So I was like, you know, I'm not writing to have this end up in a drawer. And I don't care whether it sells and I make a living out of it. I want people to read what I write. I want to connect to people. And so I turned that first script into a graphic novel called The Lost Kids. And it was a big, big experience because I literally took a 120-page film script and adapted into a comic book without knowing what the heck I was doing. Like, I always read comic books, but one thing is to read, the other is to actually go out there and make it.
Yeah.
So great experience. Long story short, that was my first time on Kickstarter. No. That's not true. That was my first time in a crowdfunding platform in Brazil. So I used that platform in Brazil first, and then I make the jump to Kickstarter a year later with something else, with another title.
And was it successful in the Brazilian crowdsourcing platform?
Yeah. So it was, like I said, huge book. Was like, it ended up being like a 200 plus page something. It took a few years to get it off the ground. Like I paid out of pocket, you know, had numerous artists from all over the place working on it. And yeah, like we had a successful campaign. The site, the website that we use called Catharsis, they had just launched, so they were still pretty small as well. So we kind of grew together. And I remember going to my first Comic-Con in Brazil, and I took that book with me, and I had such a fantastic experience, you know, just not only connecting with people picking up the book, reading it, and coming back to say they loved it, but also with my peers, you know, like the book community in Brazil is so rich, and people, like, they're tight. It's a tight community, and I just felt like I belonged. And then I did 321 Fast Comics, which was like, it was a short book. I wanted to do an anthology of short stories because the Lost Kids had been so big. So things sort of led one to another, and my first Kickstarter campaign was to fund 321 Fast Comics, much smaller book to print, and it was a much smaller campaign to launch, and that was a nail biter. You know, I think we've all been there. The first Kickstarter campaign is always the hardest.
Yeah, what's fascinating to me about your story and what I love about it is, you did the thing that everybody tells you don't do that. You started with a massive 200-page project. Everyone else would have started with a short in an anthology for very little money. And you were like, no, 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 I'm going to make the biggest thing in the world because I don't know any better.
That's what it is. I did not know any better. And I always tell people, like, I don't do what I did. Because I had to learn the hard way to start small. Like, I love Uncharted's line, greatness from small beginnings. Start small. That's the rule. That's the golden rule. And I think, if you think about it, like, it took me so long to get The Lost Kids out there that when I decided to try my luck publishing in English, I did not try with The Lost Kids. I tried with something smaller. I had learned. You know, the crowdfunding campaign in Brazil, it did work, but it was very troublesome. And I think it only worked because of certain circumstances at the time. And those were not going to be replicated on Kickstarter, which was around for a lot more time, was a lot more well established. So I wanted to start with something small. That's how 321 came to be. And I did 321 number one. I did 321 number two. You know, the Feeling Curse was like a 30-page book, issue number one. And so you start small. And you, like, I know people come to my campaigns today and they see over 1,000 backers and they're like, oh, I want to do what you do. It's like, yeah, but I started with 200 backers.
I think that approach is, here's the thing, is like, you know, I'm about to walk into a prison and convince a bunch of people to start making comic books. And I spend a lot of my time when I go to WonderCon at the end of this month. I'm going to stand up in front of a packed a hall full of, you know, would-be, will-be creators and tell them, hey, you should be doing this. And here are a few things to get you started. The biggest hump I see with everybody is they come in and they're like, I have this huge story I want to tell, and it's this epic, and it's got all these characters, and there are these twists, and there are these turns. And here's the thing, is like, that is great, because what you want to do, what you want to present a reader with, and what you want to present a publisher with, or whatever, is you want to build a world in which you can tell 100 stories, you can tell 1,000 stories, right? However, when you start, think about episode number one. Think about the first chapter. Think about the first stanza. Create the world. Introduce us to a character. Introduce some conflict. Get out. And that is very makeable. It is very doable. You go out, you do it. You figure out how to do it. You'll do it better the next time you do it. You figure out, hey, is this a story I want to? You've been doing Feeling the Curse for 10 years. You will figure out while doing that first book, do I have 10 years of this in me? Or do I need to do something else? It becomes much harder to fail when you set out to do a 30-page story than if you set out to do a 200-page story. Yeah. Becomes a better experience. It becomes a the beauty of the jump. I mean, I am now doing the fourth issue of the jump is out. I have notions of what happens after issue four. Mm-hmm. I have purposely not sat down to map out what happens. And so I take it in stanzas. I think about what is next, what is interesting, what corner of the world can I push into? And it is this like beautiful exploratory experience. I'll do a fifth issue. There may actually be a second jump series coming out. But I have notions, and every once in a while, when I have some time, I carve it out. I sit down and I'm like, okay, what's next? What character do I want to explore? What do I want to do? And it is this very organic, rewarding experience. And it keeps me, it never gets too heavy for me. It never gets too difficult. And I think that that's a really interesting, wonderful place to be with something. Yeah. And I think it is the key. It is a key to success in this, in this endeavor.
If you look at all, at everything that's been accomplished with the Finkers, you would think that, you know, Fabian and I, we planned it meticulously, yeah, and was executed. And it was really not. Like, a lot of stuff started happening along the way that sort of pulled us in different directions. So the story I love to tell the most is how the board game came to be. Because I'm not a board gamer. Like, I've never thought about, you know, turning one of my comics into a board game. But what happened was, I think we were doing the Kickstarter for issue number 3. So it was very early on, okay? And we were just starting out. We were just telling the redhead story. It was not a huge universe. She was like this lone curse chaser. Like, we were telling that story. It was a small story. And I remember, like, a backer sends me a message saying, hey, there's a board game by another creator that's very similar in tone to what you're doing. I think you should connect with that person. And then he sent that same message to Mike, you know, the board game's creator and designer. Long story short, we connected, we got along, and we decided to do a Finkers board game. So a backer put us together. So that's how that came to be. And I remember Mike was like, hey, so I need more characters. I need more scenarios, show me more corners of this world. Yeah. And I was like, I don't have that. I'm going to sit down and create it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I came up with Chronicles of the Finkers, anthology of short stories, each story sort of introducing a new character or a new corner of their world. So that was a direct product of conversations I had with Mike, the game designer.
Yeah.
And then I created a character for the board game that I enjoyed it so much that I was like, you know, she has an interesting origin story. I'm going to tell that story. That's Shadow Nation. So, you know, one thing led to another. Next thing I knew, it was like, holy, I'm building an universe.
Yeah,
I had no idea that was going on.
I told this story before, but I told it like, you know, probably 80 episodes ago. But, you know, my first comic book was this book, Aberrant, and I did 10 issues for it. And you know, it did well and won some awards and was optioned for television and the whole nine yards. In order to get Aberrant sold to a publisher, I had to submit an outline. I had to plan the whole thing. Mm-hmm. This is what happens in this issue and blah 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 blah. And as I got going, I kind of just threw it out the window. And so I am in the middle of issue 2. And you know, you have our protagonist is this badass guy who leaves the army and he's going after these guys that killed mm-hmm. his youth. And he sits down at a bar with his commanding officer, and his commanding officer is saying, hey, the army does not want you to leave. If you leave, they're going to come after you. You're going to be in trouble. And the guy says, he's sitting at the bar. He says, let him come. And the commanding officer turns to him and says, trust me, man, you don't want to know what the army has waiting for you in the basement. You don't want to know what they're going to send after you. And it was just a throwaway line. It was kind of like a tough guy movie line that I just threw out. And I typed it. And I love the line, and it was all stop. And I'm like, wait a minute, what does the Army have hiding in the basement that they're gonna send after this guy? I'd never thought about it. And I could not shake that line. And so between when I wrote issue 2 and issue 3, I spent a lot of time being like, man, I guess I got to figure out what they're going to send after him. And it ended up being this character Rook. That's kind of this like experiment gone wrong. But he was not in the original proposal, and he ended up over the course of the series turning into basically the third lead of the story.
Yeah.
There's the protagonist, there's the antagonist, and then there's this character that everybody loves. And that was him. And the entire 8th issue is devoted to him, is told through his point of view. And he was never conceived of when I submitted the initial thing. And there is this, you know, there was this part of me that wanted to kind of like push it away. It's like, okay, well, I already have my 10 issues planned out. I don't need this. But it was something that was very good. It was very rewarding. It was very interesting. And,
yep.
and it was speaking to me, and I listened and I leaned into it. And in the end, it ends up being everybody's favorite character. So listening to what the universe, these things are living, breathing entities, and listening to what they're telling you, what they want out of you, is very important. Right.
Yeah. I was going to say, I love, like, every time I decide to tell a story, I obviously go into, you know, like I do like a beat sheet, like a scaffolding outline. I do the whole 9 yards, but it's important to, I love when characters take over the story. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you think you're writing about a character that you think is the protagonist, and then someone else just takes that limelight. So I think both, the both things are run side by side. One is, yes, you want to plan what you're writing to the extent is that it's a roadmap. It's not like a, you know, it's not like a set thing that you got to follow. Right. And you got to be open to whatever, you know, life throws at you, whatever, you know, if you're writing sequential work, like putting out issues, I think it's always nice to get some feedback from fans and readers. Obviously, you know, you can't listen to it all. Their perspective is different than yours. But I think they, if someone is right, it's reading your work, I think they have a valid side of, like, point of view that sometimes it's nice listening to.
Well, I mean, you know, whatever kind of writing you're doing, because you guys are talking about creator-owned things, even with licensed stuff that I do, I often start... One of the best things about my editor-in-chief at Dynamite, and the worst things, is he never wastes my time. So he never tells me to get started on something that hasn't 100% been greenlit. The downside of that is he comes to me and says, this is greenlit and I need the script in 2 weeks for the first issue of a 5-issue series. And I'm like, well, I can knock out a first issue in a couple of weeks, but knowing what's happening in 2 through 5 is a little more of a tricky situation. And the good news is that my publisher doesn't care if the thing goes completely off the rails from what I originally pitched. They don't, you know, I used to describe it as in issue 1, most of the time in my work, I'm throwing lettuce, radishes, croutons, and cucumber in the air. And then for 4 more issues, I'm running around with a bowl going, this is going to be a salad when it lands. I swear to God, I'm just going to catch all this stuff as it hits the bowl. And we're going to get something that's delicious, but you don't always know. And, you know, it is such a writer's cliche of like characters taking over and doing what they want to do. But if you take your character seriously and you know them well, I wrote a shadow story once where, one of my first comic books where the shadow was going to escape from these bad guys. And then I had like a 3-page coda that I wanted to do. But in order for the 3-page epilogue to fit, the escape had to end on page 17. And at the bottom of page 17, someone sacrifices themselves so that the shadow can escape. And he's in a car speeding away from the bad guys. And I got to the bottom of page 17 and the shadow said, stop the car. And I went, yeah, he's going to get out and kill everybody now. he's the shadow. You don't sacrifice yourself to save the shadow without the shadow immediately avenging your death. So the Shadow took a page to get out of the shit car and machine gun everyone in sight. And I had to do my coda, my epilogue in 2 pages, and I made it work. Yeah. But the Shadow demanded justice. Yeah. And that's the Shadow. I can't say no to the Shadow if he demands. No. I'm avenging the death of that kid. Okay, fair. You know, I can't fight you on it. And you know, that's the best kind of thing to happen, really, because it's real. It's true. It's you're giving the characters their due. You're listening to them. You're listening to the voices in your head that are made up of other fictional people, which is very much its own thing. But yeah, do you find the people who follow the Few and the Cursed following you to non-Few and the Cursed projects on Kickstarter?
Some of them, for sure, yes. But I think the majority of readers, they are fans of the Few and Cursed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, they are fans of the Redhead. Mm-hmm. Because I've put out other Few and Cursed books out there. So same universe, so same style, same tone. I'm the one writing. So, you know, like it's all... and still, nothing sells books like the Redhead. Nothing.
Sure.
Like she's... I don't know what it is. She's... And to her credit, I never thought I was going to be 10 years down the road still writing her story. And the way, like, I know Ryland said that he doesn't have everything planned out, and I don't have everything planned out in detail, but I have the stories I want to tell for the next 3 or 4 seasons or arcs, if you will.
That's great.
And so I know that I have at least another 10 years worth of stuff that I need to get out that features the Redhead. And that's surprising, because I remember when Fabian approached me, he was like, hey, I always wanted to do a Western. And as much as I enjoyed some of the Westerns that I saw in class, like, I'm not one of those kids that their dad, you know, loved Westerns, loved X, watched the movies. My dad was not a Western fan. So my Western education came from film school. So it was very technical, you know, like we would discuss the genres, watch a couple of films. So I did watch the classics, Searchers, you know, Shane. But it was not, at the time, a genre that attracted me. Mm-hmm. So for me to be making a living out of a Western for the past 10 years, that it's mind-blowing. It's like, that was not planned. And I think that happened because there's something about the Redhead that I don't know what it is. I didn't create that. It's just there. Like, she's just that charismatic. She's just, whenever she's on the cover of a book, people just want to feel like they need to pick it up and get to know that character. So that's her credit. That's due to her credit. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of happened.
I think character really does trump genre, though. When I was a kid, I was a huge science fiction fan, and I'm still a fan of science fiction. Mm-hmm. But I was at a horror convention this weekend as a guest, because I write the Elvira books. I've written some other horror stuff. And, you know, among that fan group, they're like, oh, you're a big horror fan? I'm like, I'm a big fan of horror that's great, but I don't have that. I know there are horror fans who are like, they will enjoy the worst low-budget slasher movie of all time. There are Western fans who can watch the worst. Yeah. If it's got a 6-shooter in it and a guy in a hat, they love it. I am not that way about any genre. I was that way about science fiction as a kid, but partly it was because there was so little good science fiction in mass media. Mm-hmm. You had the books, you always had literature, and you had somewhat in comics. But like, I always use an example. There was a TV show on when I was a kid called The Man from Atlantis, in which Patrick Duffy from Dallas played a guy with webbed fingers who was essentially Aquaman, really. And it was terrible. But it was the only science fiction show on television when it was running. And everyone I knew who was a science fiction fan watched it. Mm-hmm. And we all agreed it was terrible, but we couldn't stop watching it.
Right.
I don't have that relationship. And I'm the same way you are with Westerns. I don't particularly love Westerns, but Once Upon a Time in the West and High Noon are two of my favorite films ever made.
Oh, High Noon is amazing. I love that one.
High Noon is great. And High Noon is about so many things beyond Gary Cooper shoot Frank Miller, apologies to the real Frank Miller, in the last scene. That's not what the movie's actually about. It teaches you a very valuable lesson about existing in society and can you depend on other people? You can't depend on but it's, you know, it's great regardless of genre, and as Outland demonstrates, and you can do High Noon in any genre you want. It works. You can adjust the parameters of that story and put him on a space station. It doesn't have to be in a small town in the West in the 1870s. And to me, that's always the sign of a great story. How many versions of Hamlet are there that don't take place in Denmark in the 17th or 16th century or whenever that's supposed to be? You know, there Othello, like you, one of my favorite movies is a Othello in a jazz club in London in the 60s. It's called All Through the Night. That's just any great story, I think, transcends genre.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think one of the keys to the success of The Thin Curse, I think it's the fact that I'm not doing a straight up Western. I'm not catering to Western fans. Like, I'm putting character first and I'm writing up and I'm putting myself first as a fan, what I'd like to read. So like, I always try like, oh, this is fun for me. So it's gotta be fun for other people as well. So that's what I said. Like, I love Indiana Jones. So there is that aspect to the world of The Thin Curse. She's always after some trinket that's going to help her in her mission, or there's like a MacGuffin that it's central to the plot. So there's always these elements, and like I said, giant creatures and monsters. I've always been fascinated by that. Sure. Not in film, but in real life. Like, I love, like, whenever I go to a zoo and I see like a massive animal, I don't know what it is, I get like bewildered. Like, I'm just in awe of the power that the creature has, and I try to, you know, find ways to put that in my work. And if obviously not all the time, but I come to think of it, it's a thing. The Thin Curse is literally, it's littered with tons of giant creatures, whether they're cursed or regular animals. I'm a big animal lover, so, you know, you're going to see cats and dogs in my stories, you know, and they have deep, meaningful relationships to their, you know, owners, like horses. So that kind of thing is always present in my work. So it might not fit the genre of Western, but I think it's what makes The Thin Curse The Thin Curse and sort of stand out from all the noise, you know, from the genre, you know.
I think as creators, it's never great if you're sitting there ticking off boxes in what should be in a Western. What makes things great is that it is your private loves and your personal obsessions and the things that mean something to you. I've used this example before, but one of my favorite scenes in any James Bond movie is in Diamonds Are Forever. And in it, James Bond climbs to the top of a casino. On the outside, he stands on the top of an external elevator, and then he fires a grappling hook and climbs in, and he discovers that the richest man in the world has been replaced by his greatest enemy. And there's something weird and dreamlike and bizarre about the entire sequence. And I've always loved it. And years later, I was reading an article with an interview with one of the producers of the James Bond movies. And he said, oh, I had this nightmare. I was pretty good friends with Howard Hughes. And I had a nightmare that I climbed up the outside of one of his casinos and found him in the penthouse, and it wasn't him anymore. Mm. And I think that scene's power comes from the fact that it's some guy's nightmare that he imposed on a James Bond movie. He said, I had this crazy nightmare once where Howard Hughes had been replaced by a supervillain, and they went, oh, yeah, that's weird interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are a lot of things you can put in a science fiction movie. Part of the magic of Star Wars is Lucas going, you know what I love is samurai movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to make a samurai movie and a Western, and it's also going to be a science fiction movie instead of it just being a science fiction
movie. Right.
Yeah. And that's his own, like, his own personal obsession is Kurosawa. So he's going like, I'm going to make the science fiction movie that I think Akira Kurosawa would make if he wanted to, which he does not.
I mean, we talked about Star Trek being Wagon Train. I mean, some of the best like police movies, crime movies are Westerns, even though they take place in, you know, in New York in the 70s. It is something that we kind of recognize internally, and it activates these things where it's like, oh, I know this, I get this, I can plug into this. Now show me something new. And if you can do that, if you can deliver on that, particularly if it's something that, that's human. I mean, the beauty of this nightmare thing that you're talking about is we maybe didn't have that nightmare, but we recognize, oh, here is a, you know, and it was kind of what I was talking about when I was talking about, you know, going to the California State Prison and how, I mean, writing has always been, you know, it's always been therapy for me. Get my demons in a room, get them on a page and beat the tar out of them. I'm working out my shit, right? And so, and whether it's in a Western, whether it's in a Justin Lin movie, you know, where like cars are blowing up and stuff like that, I'm always working out my shit. And you know, I think that, I mean, people show up for candy and sometimes they get something a little more nutritious. And I think that that is the, I think that that is the most rewarding viewing experience. You know, they see something human, they see something that they recognize themselves.
Yep.
And something that maybe they were worried was going to be stupid, even, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's a little reductive, but it's like they showed up and it's like, oh, I'm going to turn off and watch this. But then they get a meal out of it. You know, I think that that is, you know, again, it was the experience I had with Elvira Avalone, to tell you the truth, is like, you know, I am not just out of hand Elvira's audience. It's not me. But in both cases, if I watch Elvira on TV, I'm like, this woman is awesome. She is, you know, this is popcorny, but she's giving us something that is socially important. And I see it immediately. I feel it immediately. I get it. And then the Elvira comic book. I mean, I remember saying like, here's the thing is I have acquired licensed properties because Avalone showed me how fun it was to write Elvira. I was trying to figure out, what do I want to do in comics? Do I want, you know, there was a company that was offering me a job. I don't really want to write that character. Why don't I want to write that character? Let me look at how other people are writing characters. And I'm like, well, Avalone is writing Elvira. I wouldn't maybe not have chosen him out of hand to write Elvira. He seems to love writing Elvira. Let me read it. I don't know if I was 10 pages in, 5 pages into the first, you know, to the first issue that I was reading. And I was like, I get this. I understand it completely. Avalone is having the best time he's ever had doing this. It shows on the page. It is entertaining. It is awesome. And now I need to find my Elvira. And it took me a little while, but I went and found my Elvira. Announcement coming soon. But I get that. And that's the thing is like, I wouldn't have, if I didn't know Avalone, I would not have walked into a comic shop and picked Elvira down off of the shelf. And to tell you the truth, if I had gone in, and if I had my choice of 10 licensed properties, probably 8 of those books that I pulled down would not have been for me. I would have been like, that one was awesome. And part of the reason it was awesome was because I did not fully expect it to be awesome. But it was.
I hear that a lot.
I don't mean. No,
I do. That's fine.
But it was wildly entertaining.
Surprising. Yeah,
it was fun. It was wildly entertaining, and entertaining people is completely noble and awesome, and it's amazing that we get paid to do that. However, I've since read pretty much all of Avalone's Elvira work, and every issue is actually about something. There is nutrition with your candy, and I think that's so important, you know, because it's because why are we doing this otherwise?
Yeah,
this takes so much time and so much effort, and it costs so much money to get this to somebody. If it is not about something, we are doing it wrong. We are wasting our time,
Yeah, I think it goes back to what I said. That's what got me started. I never meant to write stories to be, you know, stuck in a drawer. So I want to tell stories that are about something, that they do matter, that they discuss something. Like I love having like philosophical discussions within, you know, between two of my characters. You know, The Fin Curse is not about that, but you have, and not in every issue, but in some issues, I use it like instead of just having a breather from all the action and just have, you know, something sort of like without any nutrition. I love that, you know, analogy that you're making. So I try to discuss, you know, religion a little bit, faith. Let's talk about faith in my book. So I have two characters. I purposely put them on two ends of the spectrum of whatever I wanted to discuss. I think it gives people something to think about that they might not even realize that they're thinking about it. You know, like that's what makes good stories. They have to mean something to someone. And the more personal you get, the more, you know, I know it's a cliche, but the more personal you get, the more global it is what you're discussing. We're all human. We all share the same human experience.
And that's the thing. I think the worst kind of writing is when you don't invest any part of yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, I believe that if you're doing it right, everything that you write has some element of autobiography in it.
No,
it's something that you've felt. It's something that you've seen. It's something that you've experienced. It's someone you've met. And, you know, to go back, thank you, Ryland, for all the kind words about Elvira. When I was offered that gig, I didn't know what the hell to do with her. But I rewatched the movie. I watched some of her shows and I thought, you know, she's a great vehicle for anything that I've ever had to say about horror movies. I wrote a 4-issue arc with her where she's in hell. And I didn't want it to get too serious. But on the other hand, you can't write about hell and not have an opinion about cosmic justice and the afterlife. And is it right that God operates a medieval torture chamber that doesn't really reward you if you learn anything from it? You're still stuck. Like, there are interesting philosophical questions about hell. And it's dumb to write about hell. It's meaningless to write a story that takes place in the Inferno and not have an opinion about what it all means, what it's all about, and why it exists. You have to have that. Otherwise, what the hell are you even writing about? You know, what is horror and what does horror mean to people? All of those are useful and interesting discussions. And it's the same thing with you and Westerns. The Western is just it's the platter that the meal sits on. It's not the meal,
absolutely.
You know, it's the garnish. It's the, you know, it's the colors. It's not the vitamins. The vitamins are coming from you. The vitamins are coming from what you think and feel and believe. And, you know, there's no art form, there's no medium so debased that it can't change your life. There's no, you know, you can be as silly and as entertaining as humanly possible. And you're still, even by accident, you're going to end up saying something about how life is lived and what you believe about the world. If you're terrible at what you do, you won't even know what you're saying. You know, like if you won't, you'll be saying things about yourself that you don't know you're saying. If you're really great at what you do, you have something serious to impart to people.
And I was going to just add on that is, I loved the Oscars over the weekend. I loved the awards that were given away, and two of them really caught my attention, which was Flo winning for Best Animated Feature. That's such a phenomenal film, and Anora as well. And I think if you think about it, when those creators and those filmmakers were making those films, they weren't setting out to do Oscar-winning pieces of, you know, filmmaking. They were worried about telling a good story with meat, you know, like stories that would connect with people that had something to say. Anora has something to say about the human condition. And then Flo, even more so, you know, like he's using a bunch of animals to discuss society, to discuss, you know, lending a hand to people that might be different from you. So like there's so many layers in flow.
Mm-hmm.
That
if you and it's also it's also an ecological disaster movie about climate change.
Absolutely. You know, like,
it doesn't really, that's not the plot, layers. But that's the setting of it, you know?
Absolutely. So so let's circling back to what we were discussing in the beginning. Like, I think a lot of young creators and writers out there, they have that within them. And I know because I've been there too, like, oh, I want to write my opus, you know, my big thing. And I want to discuss everything. And I want it. Like I wanna write something to win a war. It's like, no, just worry about writing a good story. It doesn't need to be life-changing, world-changing. Like stories, I think, that shape, you know, the world around them are stories that you worry about them first. You worry about telling a good story and let the audience pick that up and run with it. That's their job. Your job is to write the story.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've said this example before because it's very meaningful to me, but like I had an issue that I was dealing with about 10 years ago, a family issue, and I went to therapy and all sorts of things helped, but I stumbled across a 3-day run of Peanuts cartoons, 9 panels, maybe 12 panels. And it was more healing than anything my therapist said to me. And I had a great therapist. But it nailed a certain thing about relationships between brothers and sisters, between Lucy and Linus. And I went, that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That like it boiled it down so beautifully and metaphorically. And I still think about it all the time. There are things, you know, Captain Marvel passing his face over the Angel of Death in the death of Captain Marvel and saying, it's just that I no longer need the illusion. I think about that panel about once a week and apply it to all sorts of things in my life. I just no longer need the illusion. It's an enormously profound thing that Jim Starlin put in a graphic novel that's about a superhero who's dying of cancer, you know, and it's really, really profound. And it's as profound, like I've seen 100 movies about people dying, like, Terms of Endearment doesn't have anything that profound in it as is in Captain Marvel, you know, as is in the death of Captain Marvel. I think that's funny in its way. But I think ultimately, and then my father was a writer, and this is a lesson that he didn't teach this to me intentionally, but I learned it from watching him. You take every gig seriously.
You
take every character seriously. You take every story seriously. You know, you give everything, you give the audience everything that you can give them.
Yeah. Don't hold them back.
Yeah. Don't hold back and don't phone it in. And again, like with you, you're not condescending to the idea that it's a Western. You're not approaching a Western and I guess there's a guy in a black hat and I guess there's a, you know, I guess there's a showdown at noon on the main street. It's like, no, man, it doesn't have to be any of that. Yours, if I remember, you know, and yours is a post-apocalyptic story. It's not set in the 19th. It's not set in the 19th century in Arizona. That's not what it is, which is what most Westerns are.
Yeah,
you know. But anything, and again, I also wanted to go back to the whole thing of influence. No one is free of it, as much as George Lucas is emulating Kurosawa. Kurosawa is imitating John Ford.
Absolutely.
You know, John Ford is getting some stuff from D.W. Griffith. He's getting some stuff from Zane Grey. He's getting a lot of stuff from literature. He's getting stuff from the paintings of Remington. Mm-hmm. And the sculptures of Remington are showing up in John Ford's work. The music of Aaron Copland is making its way into John Ford's work because we all absorb this stuff. And what's interesting, of course, is that you don't spit it out exactly as you received it.
Yeah.
You run it through the filter of your experiences and what you want to, you know. I mean, and the irony is you have the worm auroribus. You have the thing where, you know, someone like Sergio Leone, an Italian sees a Japanese man turning Westerns into samurai movies and goes, you know what these would be great as? Westerns. And he turns around and make Westerns. And of course, he's making them in Spain with a bunch of Italians and one American guy. You know, and but that still comes, that makes it completely new.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. Because some of the samurai ethos that didn't come from John Ford, that comes from Kurosawa, ends up in Sergio Leone. You know, and that's...
I was going to add to that that I remember when I was young, a lot of writers and creators would tell me, like, read books, read comics, watch movies, listen to some, travel the world. You know, like, every time you experience another culture, you leave a lot more enriched in your life experience. And I remember when I was young, I was like, well, I don't need all that, you know? Like, I just want to create. I just want to sit down and write. But, you know, it's like, go live your life. You're not going to write something if you're not living. Like, you need to, you know, like you said, like being a sponge and absorb everything. And that's the thing. Even like you're traveling, you don't need to be the geek in the museum reading everything and memorizing everything. You just need to be present and you're just being the moment. Just, you know, don't travel on your phone. Just be there, eat different foods, go to museums, you know, like do other activities that you normally wouldn't do. Like, I think all that sort of stuff. I can't say how many good ideas I've gotten from traveling around, you know, from my fishing trips or for visiting Egypt or going to a museum. Like, so many great ideas just, you know, poured into my work. And even Westerns, like I said, I was never a big fan of Westerns, but once I started working in one, I started getting more curious about them, and I started to like, oh, that's a Western series. Let me check that out. Let me see what other people are doing with the genre, you know? Try living a full life and not be stuck on your phone.
I remember talking to a group of, again, like would be, you know, will be filmmakers at the University of Michigan. And, you know, they're between 18 and, you know, 22 years old. And, you know, you get the question, like, what is your one piece of advice? And I'm like, well, you're at this wonderful university. Study almost anything else.
Yeah.
You know? Like learning to make films is great, but, and it is the beauty of a place like the University of Michigan, is it's a great liberal arts university. And so you have to study literature, you have to study art, you have to study all these things. But yeah, like finding something to write about is interesting. Otherwise you're recycling things. All that said, I mean, I think we're making a really good point about influence is like, you know, we're always processing art. We're always experiencing art. If you don't see what other people are doing, you're not challenged. You're not inspired. You're not all of these things. I mean, the irony of the whole situation is you're going to make a piece of art that people are then going to process one way or another. And sometimes it's just a reader or a viewer or whatever processing it and popping off about it online. Sometimes it's going to be, you know, we've all had them. I mean, some people read my comic books. And they're like, this is awesome. I'm going to process it and I'm going to go make my own comic book. And so, so there is the direct influence and sometimes it's not, but it's interesting. I mean, it's Quentin Tarantino is all influence. And that can be done very poorly. And we saw it with people processing his work because he does Reservoir Dogs. He does Pulp Fiction. And then we have 100 horrific imitators after that were awful and unwatchable and terrible. And it's because they were not making it theirs. They were not processing it. They were not playing with it. All that said, the beauty of Quentin's work was that he consumed all of this stuff and he consumed stuff that we were familiar with and stuff that we were not familiar with, but he processed it all. He made it his in a really interesting way. Yeah. You know, it went into the Quentin blender and it was, and he added some other ingredients that were very much him. And then he spit out this wonderful shake for us all to drink. I got a little too much into the deep end with that metaphor. It became a meta five. I apologize for that, but you get what I mean. And his work is very, you know, it is very influence based, but it is also very him. In a generation of people who were kind of devouring pop culture and spitting it back out, he was great at it. And Kevin Smith was great at it in a different way. And
For me, the most recent example is Stranger Things.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. Nostalgia play.
I watched their masterclass, and you know, it's like they took everything they loved from their childhood, their films, the books that they read, the RPG games that they played, and they put it all in a blender. They processed and made something awesome that belongs to them. And then in turn, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of, you know, Stranger Things imitators. You know, there's going to be a lot of like new. So, yeah, I think it is important to learn. And I think that's a process. I don't think you can teach that. I think everyone needs to go through that. It's like, how do I take everything that I enjoy and that I'd love to play with and make it my own? Like the first few attempts, they're always going to look, you know, generic and derivative. Like they came from somewhere and you can tell. But I don't see anything wrong with that, because it is a process. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I remember like when I first started out, like if you take The Lost Kids, which was my first book, it's literally a pastiche of a lot of the stuff that I enjoyed growing up. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, like when I took the Fear and Curse and decided to, you know, a new book, obviously there's still a lot of influence there, but now I have added another step in my creative process, which is, have I seen this somewhere? And if the answer is yes, I'll change it. I'll go back and change it to something that I personally haven't seen. And I try to make it my own. But for The Lost Kids, I kind of stopped there. It's like, oh, I enjoy this. It looks creative. It looks like it's my own. I'll just run with it. And I think it's like, it's okay for people for their first pieces of work to be derivative.
Derivative, yeah.
Yes, English is a second language, guys. Don't forget about that.
Neither of us can speak Portuguese, so you're way ahead of us.
Yeah, I remember sitting with Fernando Trueba, and it was probably the second or third time that he apologized for his English being bad. And and I looked him in the eye, and I said, "How many languages do you speak?" And he's like, "Well, four technically, but I also know a little bit of Italian and blah blah blah." I'm like, "Man, I barely speak one. Yeah. So stop apologizing, please."
That's the thing, is that I think as a writer, if you're not constantly asking yourself, have I seen this before? Is if it's this a thing? I like when I see a movie where someone looks at bad guys arriving and says, "We've got company." I'm like, you didn't want to think about that for another 10 seconds, huh? You didn't want to, like, I have a scene in a comic I wrote where someone says, "We've got company," and the guy standing next to him says, "That's a bloody cliche," is what that is. You know, like, why would you even say something so lame as "We've got company"? You know, just whenever I see that in a spy movie, I'm like, really? You didn't want to just not sit around and ask someone how to do that differently.
Yeah.
You know,
and whenever someone comes up to me with a script and it sounds derivative and it's something I've seen before, I call them out, and they're always like, "Oh no, but I'm making my own and it's going to be better." And especially superheroes, you know, there's a lot of people want to have their own superheroes, and that's all well and fine. But if you're going to go up against Marvel and DC and their almost 100 years worth of superhero stories, you need a different angle. You need to bring something fresh to the table. You need something like The Boys. You need something like, you know, Kick-Ass at the time was very Spawn, you know, when it was on. So it's like, don't try just to take, like, I literally advised this kid, like, he was making a version of the Justice League. And I was like, why are you doing this? I understand you love the Justice League. I understand your passion for it. But why do you think you can do something better than Marvel and DC and all the experience that they've had over decades, you know, churning out, you know, stories about these characters? You know, just come up with something new. And it's like, no, don't worry about it. I'll make something good. And I was like,
yeah,
you know, fine.
No, and even when you're taking on a licensed thing that's existed for a while, you know, I always use as an example, I think Damon Lindelof can be hit or miss as a writer, but I thought his Watchmen series was brilliant.
Oh, and yes.
To me, the key about that is that Watchmen, the original, is brilliant. It's a great work of art. It's a tremendous thing. Alan Moore, as an Englishman, the one thing he doesn't understand about American culture is the primacy of race.
Mm-hmm.
And that when Damon Lindelof, and I can't speak to his intellectual process in creating the TV series, but he went, you know what? Alan Moore never really had anything to say about race in American culture. So I'm going to make my Watchmen almost entirely about race in American culture and how it affects everything. And that's a way to do something that Alan Moore didn't like. He found the thing Alan Moore didn't touch in his brilliant piece, and he pursued it. Mm-hmm. And that's how you do something brilliant. Is and Alan Moore himself, Swamp Thing had been around for 50, 60 issues, and it was a great story about a man who had become a monster and was trying to regain his humanity. And he takes over and he goes, "What if he was never really human? What if this guy's been lying to himself about his origin story the whole time?" And it turns it into a beautiful tragedy, and it doesn't undo the previous 50, 60 issues of Swamp Thing, which are brilliant and are beautiful, but it takes it in a direction that Len Wein and Marty Pasco never considered taking it. And that's what you do when they give you the keys to the car. You don't go, I guess I'll do this. And look, it's hard. I always use as an example, if they called me from Marvel tomorrow and said, "You're taking over the Fantastic Four," after I got excited about the job, I would have a serious moment of like, I guess they fight the Dr. Doom or something. I don't know. Like, what can you do with the Fantastic Four that Mark Waid and Stan Lee haven't done with the Fantastic Four? That's a tough one. But you can. Better writers than me have figured it out. You just you have to get out the shovel and the pickaxe and go, if I dig into this thing, what am I going to find? What am I going to find that no one has talked about, thought about, you know? And look, if you don't have that, say no to the gig. You know, if you can't find the thing, if you can't find the way in. When I got I wrote a Betty Page comic set in 1953 when she was 27 years old. And when I was first assigned it, I was like, I don't know. And I watched a documentary about her that had a unique feature that it was mostly narrated from a real interview with Betty Page. And I listened to the real Betty Page talk for 90 minutes and I went, that is an extraordinary woman and I am interested in her reaction to various spy monster action movie sequences. Like I can make her Indiana Jones and James Bond and have a really interesting story, because her response to things, her way of responding to trouble is not going to be like anybody else's you've ever read before, because she's a unique, this 27 year old model from Tennessee is not like any other action adventure hero that I can think of. So great. I got something to do now. I've got an assignment, you know, and that's the redhead for you.
I guess. Yeah. Like I never gave too much thought about it. Yeah. And it just happened. Like the way that we came up with the redhead, it was like, I made a conscious choice that I did not want a male protagonist for my Western book, for my cowboy book. I was like, nope, not going to do that. And I remember I pitched Fabiano the idea of, you know, a female gunslinger. He came back with something that was very similar to Sharon Stone in the Quick and the Dead, that Sam Raimi movie. And I was like, well, let's make her a redhead.
Let's push her at least a little bit away from Sharon. No, and I, getting back to what I was saying before, I do think as a writer, you ask yourself that question. What is the boring version of this?
Yeah.
Oh, well, absolutely. It's a dude. Like, okay, so let's step one is we're not going to do a dude. Bo Smith is a friend of mine, and he's the creator of Winona Earp, which is in a similar territory to what you do. And someone asked Bo once, and Bo's a lovely man with a great heart. And someone asked him once, like, were you trying to make a feminist statement? He's like, no, man, I was just like, the boring version of who is the descendant of Wyatt Earp is another handsome white dude with a mustache. So yeah. What do I do that's different from the boring thing that everyone else would do? The hot chick with blonde hair. And on TV, they made her a brunette. But it's that thing of Bo asked the basic writer question.
Yeah,
yeah. Now, a boring writer would make Wyatt Earp's great, 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 great ancestor, yeah, descendant another dude. So let's not do that, you know?
Yeah,
that's the boring answer.
You have, like, that's something that I constantly ask myself. Have I seen this before? Like, obviously, I haven't seen everything there is to see in the world. I haven't watched all the movies. But I, at least from my perspective, from my personal point of view, like, I always ask myself, have I seen this before? And if the answer is no, it's in the book. If the answer is yes, if I can think of even one place where I might have seen something visually like this or narratively, like in a narrative way, goes out. Try again.
And, you know, like, and the other thing is, it's so easy to change something just a tiny bit to sidestep cliche. One of my favorite David Mamet lines, there's a movie he did called Heist. And there's a scene where Danny DeVito pulls a gun on, I think it's Gene Hackman, rest in peace. And he says, I don't want to do anything so cliche as counting to three, but one. And that's so much funnier than a guy just saying, I'm going to count to three. Like acknowledging that, okay, this is a trope.
Yeah.
But the way the way it's written and the way DeVito, I don't want to do anything so cliche as counting one, you know, to three, but one.
Yeah.
And the gun comes out.
There is an interview that Matt Damon gave about The Departed. And then he was like, there is a scene where Costello, Jack Nicholson's character and his bodyguard, they shoot someone. And then I think the script ended there. Like, they just shoot someone in a parking lot or something like that. They're in a remote location. And then Jack Nicholson, and then Matt Damon was like, so, you know, what Marty does so well is that he leaves the camera on because Jack Nicholson is a great improviser. So Jack Nicholson sees, you know, his reaction to shooting someone. It's like, oh, she felt funny. That by itself is a fantastic line.
Yeah.
That brings a lot of things. It's like, oh, she's done this. He's done this so many times before. He knows how dead bodies fall.
Right.
And then he goes on like, so they left the camera on. And then Matt Damon makes a point like, just leave the camera on. You can always edit it later. So they left the camera on. And then she's like, oh, she felt funny. And then the guy turns to him and says something like, they usually don't do like, and then, you know, Costello goes like, did she look this hot? She looks hot right now. So they start riffing.
Yeah.
And then they gave Scorsese a lot of material that to go into the cutting room and sort of cut that sequence together. And in the script, all it did was say they shoot someone, person falls dead.
Yeah.
No, I have to say, as I do some acting myself, and it is a gift when they don't say cut, you just keep talking.
Yeah.
You just, you know, what's the next thing I would say when this happens, you know? And what I, you know, I think as a writer, you have a bit of an advantage, you know, and some actors are natural storytellers. And they know what the character would say next. They're in the character's head. They know how he would feel. They know, you know, what he would do. And you can definitely always find gold there, you know?
Yeah.
But before we wrap up, I did want to ask, with your Kickstarter success, aside from recognizing the popularity of the redhead, is there anything else that you can think of that is part of the formula when you're, like, I noticed your first campaign, you had a good video, you're in it, you introduce it, you're at Disneyland, which is funny. And then in the most recent one, instead of it just being comics panels, you added animation to it. Like, how long have you been doing animation, and have you found that that's helpful? Like, if you have any helpful hints for Kickstarter, I'm sure the people listening would love to hear them.
I think the biggest tip I can give people it's a two-parter. So part one is consistency. You know, with each campaign, it gets easier. But the second part of that question or that tip is, not only you need consistency, but treat your backers like real human beings, as in if they leave a comment, write back. If they reach out via message, write back. You know, I think I've always had, and I think that's been like a key differentiator, if you will. I've always had, I always need to answer. Like I unless I missed the comment, message, email, whatever it is, you get a response from me. So be very responsible with your communication with backers. You know, put out updates, constant updates. Like, look, delays are going to happen. I'm the king of delays. You know, like because like I can go on for another hour about everything that has gone wrong running Kickstarters throughout the years. You're muted.
I was gonna say, I remember back in your campaign and you being delayed by a massive hurricane. I remember
That happened once. True story. For me, the most the strangest one was, like, I remember when they were supposed to have delivered a truckload of stuff, or maybe not a truckload, but we're talking about like a ton of things. Like, and I'm not being, capricious about it. It was literally a ton,
a thousand pounds.
Okay? And it was supposed to be delivered here in Florida. And at first, the transport company couldn't locate it. They couldn't find the truck. They didn't know where it was. They're like, we'll find it. You know, nothing happened to it. And then I remember they found it in like some place, you know, like in Boston, like up there, like New York. It was so far away. It's like the guy made a wrong turn, and instead of going into Florida, he went all the way up to Baltimore, something like
crazy. Wow.
So I could go on, but you know, and like if you take a look at my track record right now, I've done like 30 or so campaigns. I owe people some of them, you know, like I ended up running back-to-back campaigns, and I'm sort of fulfilling them like one after the other, but they piled up. The reason people continue to back my campaigns is because I'm honest. You know, if you're late because something happened, tell your backers. Don't go into silence mode and trust that old adage that like, oh, don't say anything until you have something good to say. That's BS. Right. You know, your backers deserve more than that. So like if you have bad news, treat them as like grown-ups. Give them the bad news. Hey guys, the book's gonna be late by a year if it needs to be. But you know, at least they'll take you seriously. If you take them seriously, they'll take you seriously. So I think it's very, very important. I see a lot of creators that they get behind on their fulfillment. And they retreat, they go into silent mode, and they don't talk to their backers. So they leave people in the dark, and that's the worst feeling in the world. You know, people know I'm behind on my things, obviously, because they haven't received their rewards yet. But they're not wondering what's going on. Like, I'm giving them dates, even though, like, I adjust them, I'm still giving them dates, and I'm letting them know. So this project, we're going to print. This project is, you know, it's a script stage. One of the projects that's been really delayed, it's one of the Filmicore's original graphic novels called Hidden Away, which is, I took Goonies, which is one of my favorite movies. That was my biggest inspiration. I was like, I'm going to do a Goonies-inspired adventure in the world of the Filmicore's. And when I started out writing it, I had this story planned out. And as I was writing it, the characters, it was a large cast of characters, they took over. And the story got away from me. And I didn't know how to get it back on track. And the only deadlines that I have are with my backers. So I was like, I literally wrote an update telling them, guys, I'm stuck. I don't know how to finish this story. I don't want to just turn something crappy just for the sake of it. I'm going to take some time. I don't know when I'm going to be finished with this script, but I'm going to take some time with it, you know, and I'll keep you guys updated. And then I delayed the project by like 3 or 4 months or something like that. But I eventually found the story And then, you know, I announced it's like, hey guys, I finished the script. We're back on track. We're like, so they knew that I was late because I literally had writer's block, or if that's a thing. I don't think it's a writer's block. Like, it's not like if I sat down to write something generic and cliched, I would have finished that story. But I didn't want to give that to backers because that's not what I promised them. So two things, consistency and communication. I think like you talked about animation or video. I hate being on camera. I'm not fond of it. I tried several things. So if I can avoid being on camera, I'll take that. And I noticed that people don't really like, they know me well enough already that they don't need to watch me on camera. And the reason that we switched up from comic book panels to sort of animation style is because my editor, we started working together 10 years ago, and over 10 years, he got a heck of a lot better. So
he developed skills.
And I went along with it, you know, so I wrote the script and he runs with them. You know, I just approved animation. So I think it's also like, if you find good people to work with, hold on to them as much as possible.
Sure.
You know? And really see their what they're bringing to the table. Like, you know, see their worth in your work. You know, we're doing something that it's a collaborative effort. And I think we need to, you know, take notice of people's contributions, you know.
Mm-hmm. And treat them with respect. Well, that's great advice, Felipe. And it's been great talking with you. We will have the link to your current Kickstarter when we put up the video. Where can people find you online?
I'm on Instagram at Felipe Cagno, C-A-G-N-O. As far as I know, I'm the only one. So if you look up Felipe Cagno, you spot me. And we also have a the Film and Course Instagram account as well. I think Instagram, I think, is probably the best. I'm on Facebook as well, but not as active. I don't check it regularly.
Sure.
And Kickstarter. I go into Kickstarter every single day. So if you leave a comment on one of the Kickstarter campaigns or shoot me a message, I'll get it. I'll see it.
Great.
You know, even when I don't have a campaign on, I'm still checking out Kickstarter every day. I just love that place.
That's great. And Ryland, where can people find you online?
It's a good place. You can find me on Kickstarter. Also, my astral projection thriller, The Jump, is live right now. All four series one issues are available right now. We take on the election with this newest issue. It is quite the dance. You're going to enjoy it. Other than that, I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. That is R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T, if you're just listening. I have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents just drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me. So I have to spell it for you. But yeah, go get The Jump. Go back The Few and The Cursed. And yeah, bring us home, Avalone.
Much like Felipe, I think I'm the only David Avalone on most social media sites, so I'm pretty easy to find everywhere. I'm on most social media active on Blue Sky, but I'm also on Facebook, and I have a website, davidavalonefreelance.com. As I said at the top of the show, Savage Tales is in stores, Drawing Blood is in stores, the Drawing Blood volume on trade paperback is in bookstores, fine bookstores everywhere. And you can watch the TV show that I write on Batwheels on Max and on Netflix. My writing's mostly in the second season, which is only on Max at the moment, but it's a fun show. It's a kid show, but it's wildly entertaining, and I recommend it highly. Thank you, Felipe, for joining us, and we'll see you all on the next exciting episode of The Writer's Block.
Take it easy, guys.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.